Right, so Akash will be talking about operational risk today. Now, if I remember correctly from my studies, operational risk is defined as the loss due to inadequate processes, systems, and people, or something like that. So it almost includes everything. And I think if you look at some of the major corporate failures, it can be pulled through to operational risk failure. So it will be interesting to see what Akash has for us today. And Akash is from Barclays, and we've got more and more actually working in the banking space. Some of you probably attended the banking seminar earlier this year, and you know about the banking fellowship that's just been launched. So I also see opportunity for a lot more action in this space. So just a bit about Akash. Akash is the current head of operational risk for Barclays Africa. He spent 20 years in various risk finance and audit roles, largely within the financial services sector. His experience stretches over a number of markets in Africa, Europe, and the Far East. In his current role in Barclays Africa, Akash oversees the firm's enterprise risk management framework, operational risk policies and standards, the operational risk capital model, and advises senior management and the board on the operational risk profile, including investment and remedial responses to ensure that it remains within appetite. Akash is passionate about developing risk management discipline in South Africa, particularly in universities and at entry level into organizations, and in his free time, he enjoys traveling and experiencing different cultures. So that's quite a mouthful, and over to you. Thanks, Akash.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you hear me? Right, okay, good. Interesting discussion on ASA, and from an enterprise risk management framework, a lot of overlaps and similarities. So one thing to get off the table, our ERMF framework in Barclays is heavily banking focused, and Edward, our wealth investment management and insurance chief risk officer, is currently doing a lot of work in tailor making that for that business. So he's a global owner of our insurance risk management framework in our businesses, but it remains heavily banking focused. And from what I was listening to in the previous discussion, I think our non-banking businesses have benefited from an operational risk perspective on some of the more established banking disciplines. So from an ERM perspective, we've got a fairly simplistic risk management process and steps. Very conveniently, it's also titled ERM, so evaluate, respond, and monitor. And as I said, very easy. Under the evaluate step, we identify and assess our risks. Okay, we normally look at the risks that have a most significant impact on our businesses, either from a probability or likelihood and strategic impact perspective. The response steps looks at remediation, remedial actions, or risk investments, or just avoiding risks altogether, or changing our business strategy. And the monitor steps looks at ongoing review of our risk profile, business performance, risk performance, losses, control performance, etc. And it's closed loop. So clearly, if our profile is moving out of appetite or getting too close to appetite, we need to look at whether we have identified all the risks or risks have changed. Our responses are no longer adequate. So fairly simplistic. And I'll go into not too much depth, because I know this is not an operational risk practitioner conference, around how operational risk uses a three-step process in Barclays. So this is what I'm going to cover. What is operational risk, how we manage it, and some of the top current and emerging risks within the banking sector, and a lot of it overlaps clearly with the wider financial services sector. So the MC is fairly close, right? In his definition. That's a Basel definition of operational risk. It's now being used more widely across financial financial services sector, but even outside the financial services sector in some of our retailers as well. So it's very vague and high level. Is from human factors and failed internal processes and systems, etc., and external factors, are intentionally vague, because anything can cause an operational risk in an organization. Every employee, every activity, every system, and even externally, every customer, every supplier, every regulator. So intentionally broad. There's no easy way to get more precise in a definition. It's a discipline that has very simple concepts, but can get very complicated in execution, given the nature of operational risk. So let me get straight into how we manage operational risk. And a lot of this terminology may seem unique to our organization, but the concepts are consistent across the banking industry. Right? It's consistent with the expectations of our regulators and sound principles of operational risk management as published by the Basel Committee. So I've again split it up between evaluate, respond, and monitor, so ERM. Very importantly on the side is the tone from the top, and our previous speaker spoke about that. So it's ownership from senior management and our board. It's the culture within the organization, and in between how the tone from the top goes into the tune in the middle, right? So in many organizations where I've spoken to senior management or board members, they say all the right things when we talk risk management, but when we talk business performance, and those kind of priorities around revenue, et cetera, go into the organization, the tune from the middle is something totally different. So you could have very good narrow conversations, but it's important to have very good broad conversations with a wider population. And I'll touch later on culture and conduct risk later in the presentation as well. So under evaluate, these are the most common methods to evaluate operational risk in a typical organization. A risk-controlled self-assessment is exactly what it says. Businesses identify their the key risks, okay, and the method used to mitigate risks in that process is purely controls. Okay? Clearly, there are other methods used to manage risk, but in that process, it's controls. This is controlled testing and assessment that is done, and very easy. Effective, we okay. Ineffective, there's a response. So either change the design of the control or ensure that it's if there's an operational problem, then we fix an operational problem. And that's a simplistic definition, right? Gets more, again, as I said, it gets more complicated in execution. So there's some simple questions. So at what level do you pitch a risk? So if I looked at two global banks in Europe, okay, similar size and scale, similar types of products across similar markets, et cetera. We had a look at a conference in the UK at their risk and control self-assessment, so their RCSAs. One had 100 risks in their RCSAs. The other had 16,000 risks in the RCSAs. And I guess it depends on what you want to achieve out of it. So if the audience for your risk control self-assessments are boards and executive management right at the top, you focus on risks that keep them awake at night. Right. If the audience of your RCSA is middle management, the guys that manage the businesses day to day, etc., probably going to have a lot lower level of risks in your RCSAs. The mistake that many organizations make is trying to have a one size fits all approach, and it gets stuck somewhere in the middle, and it doesn't actually meet anyone's requirements. So. Clearly, the way risk control self-assessments are done, or should be done in many organizations, it's at a process level in organizations. So you understand your business critical processes, normally end-to-end. That's the preferred route. Agnostic to the structure of an organization, so you might want to understand your entire customer take-on process, or the claims management process, or in finance, your entire reconciliation process, etc. And pull out the risks that could have a most material impact on those processes and align to that the controls as well. One of the reasons to do it at a process level rather than coming up with a genetic library of risks that are this populated everywhere is that you can also focus on efficiency of the process, the customer impact if you make certain decisions of putting controls. There's a focus on getting the balance right between preventative and detective controls. And you can also isolate the cost of control as well. In when I look at the way RCSA is done in organizations, when it's done on an end-to-end and on a couple of pilots that we've done, we've managed to reduce the number of controls in a typical process by about 40%, but fewer controls, but more controls, more control, generally speaking. So it has huge cost implications depending on where you pitch it and how you do it. RCSAs are normally done at a point in time, maybe twice a year, so very lag in nature as a risk management process. It's a fairly extensive activity, so it cannot be done more frequently. It may be done when there's a material change in the business and you want to reassess your risks and controls. But normally, to complement RCSAs, most organizations also use risk metrics as well that are more near real-time, certainly looked at more frequently, sometimes multiple times a day or daily, certainly not less frequently than monthly. And examples of risk metrics for different risk types, maybe on technology, system uptime as a percentage, so probably in your tier one systems you'll want 99% uptime, tier two systems maybe 95%, on people risk, maybe vacancy rates and turnover rates, on core business transactions, error rates, or timeliness of processing, etc. So you could come up with a number of metrics to actually look at risk in a more real-time basis of an organization, clearly with thresholds that say what's within the outside of appetite. So currently in Barclays, across all our risks, we actually have around 160 metrics that we monitor on an ongoing basis. It covers all our major risk types. Whereas RCSAs are normally done at a process level within businesses, most metrics are normally done by risk type, so depending on the taxonomy of risks that you may have. We touched on scenarios in the earlier presentation. We currently use scenarios for more extreme events. So the first two, day-to-day business as usual management, on scenarios we normally look at one in 5, 1 in 10, 1 in 20, 25, and possibly 1 in 100. So it's a more extreme impact, lower probability, but very plausible for us. And relevant examples, for example, is electricity blackout in South Africa. Had it in 1 in 25, now it's like a 1 in 3. Right? a pandemic in some of our markets outside of South Africa, very real. It's an extreme risk, but plausible. Right, and the probability moves as we get more information. A data center going down through a terrorist threat, as an example. Now, there's various ways in which, under respond actually, that we can actually respond to those risks. We may decide to try to manage those risks better. So, for example, in a data center scenario, beef up our disaster recovery site, or not put everything in a single data center. There's ways to actually manage those risks. In a total power blackout scenario, do we shut down the banking system and bring it back up to manage that risk appropriately? And when do we do that? Do we do it after most likely 24 hours or 48 hours of total blackout throughout the country? So those are the kind of decisions that we need to make on the respond on scenarios. Currently, amongst the major banks that are on advanced measurement approach for capital purposes, all of them use scenarios as a key input, and the bulk of them are using scenarios as only input, right? With loss data and other data points informing the scenarios and not going directly into our capital model. Strategic risk assessments is a tool we use to focus exclusively on execution risk. So business objective execution risk, it's normally done at our strategy setting, as part of a strategy setting process when we look as an organization on how well we've executed the strategy, normally just after a year and when we need to explain the results. And the type of risks that we look in there are very explicitly aligned to our strategic objectives. So for example, many financial services industries want to migrate customers from bricks and mortar to digital channels, and execution risk is the ability to deploy technology platforms. Or nearly all our financial services companies in South Africa are looking to expand in the rest of Africa, into multiple markets, and execution risk is potentially not getting approval from regulators in those countries, right? Or so there's various types of execution risk that may not be very explicitly captured anywhere else in our risk management process, and therefore needs to be looked at separately. From a response, I've discussed that to an extent. So we can either respond by making investments proactively in risk management, but if we don't, then we'll have to fix it when something goes wrong. Obviously, the preference is to invest upfront. On risk events, those are significant losses, significant non-financial impacts of an issue arising. And the response there is, very importantly, if you want to test whether your risk management framework is working, is that you learn from your lessons. If a risk materializes in one part of the business, especially if it's an operational risk, it's very likely that that risk is relevant to the rest of the organization. Right? Technology, people, payment type risk, physical security, premises is relevant to an entire organization. You make a mistake once, right? You don't make a mistake twice. Very important, and we spend a lot of time on lessons learned, and it's hugely value added to understand whether a particular event or an issue we pick up on one part of the organization is pervasive or not, right? And that's fairly understated in many risk management frameworks, possibly one of the high value adds that's very simplistically and easily implementable in organizations. And finally, monitor is when we continuously monitor the profile against appetite. And monitoring the profile is business performance, risk performance, losses, events, control effectiveness, how our metrics are performing. And it's a closed loop, so if you see something, profile deteriorating or moving in the wrong direction, we need to go back, as I said before, and look at whether we've identified all the risks, or our responses remain appropriate, et cetera. So it is a closed loop and overlaid on the tone from the top. And that's critically important. If you don't get that right, this stuff on the right hand side is really not sustainable. Right. So moving on to away from framework elements and to what's really impacted. So today's operating environment, nothing too surprising any. I'm sure most of you have seen this and would agree with this. So technology advances has always been there. It's just happening very differently nowadays at a much faster pace with much more severe impacts if you're not with the game. Our customers want to be always, everyone is always on and connected, except you, I don't see getting a signal in this room, but generally everyone is always on and connected, and the power is going to the individual and to the customer, and they want to do things themselves, and they want to do it 24/7, not from 8 to 5, and we just need to change the way we operate in financial services, and that changes the way we manage operational risks. Very frequently, we are getting calls at 10 on Saturday night saying that some of our systems went down and fraud, et cetera, and we've got exposure, and what do we do for the next 10 minutes, et cetera. And that's the nature of managing operational risk in the current environment. It's certainly not 8 to 5. There's new players in the market, so retailers coming in, and cellular service providers, and others coming. And therefore, it's forcing us to partner with different types of people with different approaches to operational risk and different views on it, right, compared to the financial services sector. Transparency is demanded, okay? You would see a lot in the press in the past around banking costs, and clearly the market wants to understand better what the makeup of fees, the fee structures, et cetera, are, and then expanded regulation. And I'll touch on that later. So how is that translated into some of top of mind issues? And these are not only my issues. Okay, if you've looked at big events on operational risk exchange, which is it's a repository of industry data across the world from the major financial institutions, dominated by banks, but some of the insurance companies have now put their data on as well, and other research notes. So I'll go into more detail on the items in red. So I'm not going to cover it now. So fraud and financial crime is in a different dimension altogether, happening much quicker, more sophisticated and complex, crossing borders, right? There's no borders anymore. And from a financial crime perspective, from a money laundering and sanctions perspective, much harder to detect. Okay, so not using simplistic schemes anymore of just putting money into accounts and moving it offshore, etc. So it's going through small business and medium businesses. As I said, looking very legitimate, etc. Nothing too suspicious about it, getting audited financials, but it just doesn't exist. When you go to visit it, it's just a money laundering scheme. So much harder to detect and much more global. So it's not restricted to specific jurisdictions anymore. So money's moving fast across the globe. A huge cost for anyone in the financial services sector, and very difficult to manage. And you have to have an in-depth understanding of your customer. Much easier in a corporate and investment banking type environment where you have fewer large customers. Much more difficult in a retail environment where you've got millions of customers. Big data management, I've seen data later in the presentation, so I wouldn't get into more detail, but data is becoming a big strategic opportunity for many organizations. Using some of the Google principles in the financial services sector, so using data to understand customer behavior. Great opportunities from a financial performance perspective, big risk if you get it wrong from an operational risk perspective. So that's a big focus area, outsourcing and insourcing. On outsourcing, some of the big risks are with suppliers that are dominant in their markets or are monopolies. So in South Africa, Eskom and Telkom, and before we went online, with statements via online channels and email, etc., South African Post Office, right, as well. What we found recently as well, very importantly, is that we do not only focus on the big suppliers, so there's a lot of small suppliers that could bring down business critical processes if they are not functional as well. So it's important to look at suppliers based on the impact they have on the organization rather than the size of the contracts or just the scale of these suppliers. Insourcing, very relevant to multinational, large organizations across jurisdictions. So a lot of big companies have set up production shops in low-cost hubs across the world. It becomes an issue when you have businesses in different jurisdictions relying on those hubs, so separate legal entities, separate boards, separate regulators, sometimes minority interests. So you have to demonstrate that insourcing arrangements are done on an arm's length basis with market prices, that you'd monitor performance of internal suppliers in the same way that you'd monitor performance of outsourced suppliers with similar implications as well. And that's becoming a hot topic, not only for boards within some of these large multi-jurisdictional companies, but also with regulators as well. There's other implications as well, so there's tax implications, which your transfer pricing, etc., that need to be considered as well. Attraction and retention of talent, very relevant in the African market, not only in South Africa, but clearly as businesses expand in the rest of the continent. Certainly demand for highly skilled people exceeds supply. So it's not only driving up the costs, but it's creating a risk around the tenure of people in organizations. So highly skilled people in some of our markets outside of South Africa are spending on average between 1.5 and 2 years with us, with the better part of the first year just investing in the development and understanding the organization, and that's a real risk in the organization. It certainly slows down strategy execution and increases short-term operational risk. And unfortunately, it's not only global multinationals that are all entering markets in the same place together with South African companies, but there are more local startups, financial services companies as well in these individual markets. So I'll go into some of the areas that are marked in red. So in technology, I mean, one of the big challenges we have in financial institutions with a long history and have been around for a while is legacy systems and how we deal with legacy systems. And this is really a significant risk, and at times it's a bigger risk than cyber and some of the other stuff we hear around technology that sounds better. This is a big risk in the organization, in many organizations. So there's different ways in dealing with legacy systems. Right? There's a local bank that decided to replace their core banking system and spent somewhere between 10 to 15 billion rand, and it's not over as yet, and it's not working. Right? There's other banks that have decided to retain so JP Morgan, for example, retain their legacy core banking platform, which is 25 years old, but has not built any functionality on it and decided to put the middleware on top with the functionality, with a lot of interfaces. That brings its own risk, really, with a complex architecture. And related to that are interconnecting systems with legacy systems and strategic decisions as to whether you have one big system with a lot of small systems, or you just have separate systems for each of the businesses, or you choose something in between. All of it has different types of risk, and all of it has an impact on system performance and system stability and security and resilience and support risks as well. So we did an exercise to work out the number of systems in each of the banks in South Africa, and the average number is around 500 individual systems amongst the big four banks in South Africa. And that's the average. And that's what we could actually find, and that's what's totally visible. And you can imagine the risk associated with such a large infrastructure to manage. On cyber, that's on the agenda later, so I'm not going to get into detail on cyber. The issue with cyber is that it's not very well understood, certainly by boards and senior management. There's no underreaction. There's always an overreaction. It's a lot of education that still needs to happen on cyber. So initial approaches was to just to build a wall around the organization as high as possible and don't let anyone in. That doesn't work. They'll go around underneath or use some other simplistic methods. In one instance, what we've seen is somebody dropping a very nice looking memory stick outside the entrance to the bank, and a staff member picking it up and saying, "Oh, that's nice, let me see what's in it." And all our systems are online for everyone to see. So it can be very simple methods used as well. So we have to assume that people are going to get in. So internal defenses are very important. Simple stuff like access control, monitoring usage of our systems, looking at what administrators and super users on systems can do, looking at audit trails, looking at which ports and which systems need to be encrypted, or even laptops, and which ones shouldn't be, and continuously managing those risks. Look at data leakage and what's moving out of the organization, not only through ports, but through emails and uploads onto Facebook and et cetera. So this is controlling all of that internally on the assumption that somebody's going to get in. Right. So on average, we have 4,000 attempts a week to get into organizations, to our organization. No material issues thus far. And this is South Africa. Less susceptible to this at this stage. Can you imagine what happens at global banks where there's a huge payoff at the end? What we've also found in cyber is that you are only as strong as your weakest link. So what financial institutions or banks specifically have tended to done in the past is spend a lot of money in their big operations where they could afford it, lock everything down and get it done, but then somebody just goes to one of your smaller operations, less affordable, weaker infrastructure, and that gets in through there, because inadvertently they are connected to the global group. And there's various reasons for cyber. So I know some people do it for financial benefit, or corporate espionage, or political reasons, and just for fun, right? And some people just do it for because they have a view on something, principle. Like those with the Ashley Madison account here, you know what I'm talking about. So the probability is that one of you at least has an Ashley Madison account. So yeah. Okay. Regulatory demand, this is obvious, and I agree with my previous round of speakers, it should not be done purely for compliance perspective. We need to understand the reasons for regulations, and most regulations are out there to enforce strong risk management in an organization, and that's the way we need to approach it. Right? So they, no doubt the regulations in scale are becoming more demanding. You're looking at a wider range of issues. Some greater focus on customers, or business continuity and recovery and resolution planning, greater focus on capital health for individual jurisdictions as opposed to at a group level or conglomerate level. Certainly greater influence on business strategy than was in the past. In the past it was very operational in nature, but certainly now impacting where what kind of businesses financial services goes after and what they don't go after. A greater punitive actions from regulators, and I have a slide later with some of examples of some of the fines and penalties globally. A big issue, certainly in the banking markets, is one size fits all. So a copycat approach to regulations. It's normally developing markets taking global regulations into some markets where it just does not make sense from a commercial or even an implementation perspective, purely because of infrastructure. And greater scrutiny. So more invasive, more on-site reviews, more collaboration with external auditors and internal auditors. And that's increasing. So typical regulators generally starts off at best uncomfortable. No matter what you tell them, so there will always be scrutiny from regulators. Another big point is regulators are starting to talk to each other more. So in the banking sector last year, there was the first banking college of regulators held. So they looked at all the banking regulators, regulators that regulate each of the big four banks across all the markets in which they operate, and called all of them together. And started to discuss what each other know about knows about the organization, and as expected, tend to be very conservative and take the worst case view amongst all of them. Right. And then that just perpetuates regulatory scrutiny and punitive measures that that they've taken. The trick, though, is as was previously said, is to treat this as good risk management practices. Engage with regulators early enough while in drafting stage as opposed to being reactive. And more specifically from an operational risk perspective is to build compliance to these regulations into business processes rather than bolting it onto businesses or business processes. If it's bolted on, it's not sustainable, right? And it's going to fail and it's going to be costly. It needs to be seamless and invisible to the people in the frontline. They do not need to know that they're doing it for regulatory purposes. They need to know they're doing it for good, as a good business practice, right? And the only way to do that is to make it business as usual, and it's in the design of your processes, etc. And then finally, culture and conduct risk. I must admit, didn't receive the focus that it should from an operational risk discipline perspective until 2 to 3 years ago, following some fairly significant events in the market. And at Barclays, we've got a separate framework for conduct risk. There's only two banks, two big global banks that have separate frameworks. It's Barclays and RBS. And basically, there's two major causes of conduct risk in organization. It either could be bad judgment or bad calls or inappropriate calls, or it could be a catastrophic operational failure in the business. Right, so it's how you execute operational risk. And I've got some of the fines and penalties and cost of customer restitution globally. I've put it in dollars and pounds, unfortunately, because I can't use, I gave this presentation in on Monday, and if I put the Rand figure, we've been inaccurate today. So the bottom line is 600 billion Rand worth of fines and restitution, customer restitutions on this page. And I haven't even included everything. So the mortgage crisis in the U.S. is not included here. The forex rigging issues are not included here. And certainly all the sanctions and anti-money laundering breaches, which Standard Chartered, et cetera, are not included here. So the number is astronomically higher. Bank of America budgeted $12 billion $12 billion for fines and penalties for 2015. That's what's budgeted for and they expect. Kind of asking for the fines. One of the most significant one that is probably relevant to the audience in this room is payment protection insurance in the UK. The bulk of the cost there is customer restitution. And it seems silly now in hindsight that you would sell, for example, unemployment insurance to a retired person who's not working, but that's what happened and that's what was in the fine print. And that's what the banks made, or certainly the insurance companies and some of the banks made a lot of money on as part of a bundle of products. Individuals did not understand what they were purchasing. We don't know why they bought it, but clearly it's because they did not see, as I mentioned before, transparency of the costs in the contracts that they've purchased. And I believe that this is going to escalate, and it's going to escalate in our African markets and certainly almost more immediate term in our South African market. Probably not matching these figures, but certainly much higher than what we've seen today. We've seen it outside the banking sector, competition tribunal posing some fairly harsh penalties in the bread sector and the construction sector, but I think this will migrate shortly to the financial services sector as well. So again, just to reiterate from a culture and conductor's perspective, tone from the top, accountability, effective challenge to from the second and third line of defense, and appropriate incentives. And I just want to touch on the incentives for a bit. So from an EU and UK perspective, the regulators in those jurisdictions kind of proposed to kind of told the banks that are domiciled as and which act as home regulators in those jurisdictions, but they need to implement fairly prescriptive remuneration practices in those organizations. So there's a cap on variable remuneration. There's a very precise definition of variable remuneration to ensure that nobody gets around that. There's deferred bonus schemes in those organizations as well. And very recently and added as well is clawback arrangements with employees, even if they have left the organization. All right, so a legal clawback of between 7 to 10 years on remuneration should something come up subsequent to them leaving or subsequent to them being paid out. So this is getting really serious, and if the financial sector does not appropriately respond to this, they will be forced to respond in ways that they probably prefer not to, right, by these kind of measures. Okay, so I'll wrap up there and I'll start backwards. So just to summarize, tone from the top, critical, executive ownership, very important in a complex environment to keep your risk management steps simple, and certainly agile as technology plays a bigger part. Educating senior management and boards on some of the risks such as cyber and more complex fraud risks are important, and the need to proactively engage with regulators, either to influence regulations or to implement it within a reasonable timescale to make it business as usual in our organization is paramount. And what I didn't mention, which is very relevant here, is operational risk needs to be also integrated with other risk types. So as mentioned previously, there's operational risk in credit risk, market funding, insurance, underwriting. There's operational risk all over the place, so it should not be looked as a one-dimensional risk. It can really happen anywhere at any point in time. So that's what I have to say. I'll take questions from the floor.
From Discovery. Gosh, thanks for a very interesting presentation on operational risk and the way you go about measuring and monitoring it. Well, actually, on the measuring, if this isn't too difficult a question for a short question and answer session, How do you go about the quantitative assessment of operational risk and capital requirements?
Okay, so currently in Barclays, and we are really looking at this at the moment, although the regulators told us not to change any of our capital models for the next 9 months. But what the big banks, the big four banks do, and I think Investec is going down this route as well, is at the moment we utilize key risks or risk scenarios, extreme risk scenarios, as a primary measure to estimate our capital. So we currently estimate the impact of our most extreme scenarios by risk type at a 1 in 7, 1 in 25, and 1 in 100 level. And then we extrapolate that to a 1 in 1,000. And we decide based on that, on the assumption that our current risk management techniques and what we've budgeted for does not cater for those scenarios. We hold capital for those scenarios in our model. When formulating those scenarios, we certainly look at internal loss data, external loss data. So unfortunately, in Africa, the loss data is fairly thin at the moment. But what we do is use global loss data and scale that down to more appropriate levels. And then we also look at what kind of issues may have perpetuated themselves in the wider industry or internally that may not have resulted in losses at this point. Maybe we are lucky that we'll also factor into the model. So we do it by risk type. So we've got 16 risk types in operational risk, ranging from technology, cyber, information and data risk, some of the more complex ones to some of the simpler ones such as physical security, property type, risk payment, people risk. And that forms a basic driver of our operational risk capital. Now, currently in Barclays, South African businesses, most of our South African businesses use the capital model to quantify capital, but our operations outside of South Africa and some of our other operations use either the basic indicator approach or the standardized approaches, which are simpler, more one-dimensional measures of capital. So it's normally a percentage of gross income by business line. So if it's a trading business, higher percentage of gross income is perceived to be higher risk. If it's a transactional business, perceived to be lower risk, lower percentage of gross income. That's normally done in our smaller operations or where local regulators do not support an AMA model. So that's the arrangement with the sub across the industries. You cannot implement an AMA model in any jurisdiction in which you operate in unless the local regulator adopts the AMA approach for the market. And that's just because of local oversight. All the banks have, by the way, have also got an add-on. So irrespective of what the AMA number comes up on, there's a minimum capital requirement which cannot be less than 85% of the standardized approach. And I know for a fact that if you look at the financial reports of all the banks, all of the AMA models are currently reflecting a lower number, which means apart from for risk management purposes, and there's no other risk measurement benefits of actually having a more complicated capital model. But certainly it's useful for risk management.
Thank you, Coach. My name is Arthur
House
from Argonne Career Solution. You mentioned the LIBOR manipulation. And that's affected the home market. You get trillions of dollars in interest rate swaps, etc. Has Barclays actually addressed that particular issue? It's really difficult. You've got to get down to the guy right at the bottom. Just a bit of an idea of how you actually address manipulation like that.
At the time that it happens, and Barclays had at that point proactively disclosed that matter to the market before any other banks, and that's the reason eventually the fines and penalties are much lower than our counterparts. So you are right. Very detailed investigations was done at a trader level. Right, so it was not at a desk level or at a very aggregate level, but each trader was investigated individually, and that's the only way you actually get to the bottom of it. Clearly, it would only be successful through collaboration with other players in the market. So at the time that Barclays had disclosed it, it was fairly obvious that other players in the market were aware of it. as well, and all of them have subsequently gone through a similar review. Clearly, the Barclays was the guinea pig in terms of the approach to the investigation, which was overseen by the regulators on an ongoing basis, and the other banks involved went through a similar process. Very difficult to quantify, because somebody could have taken out a home loan based on a LIBOR rate, and we don't know whether they may or may not have taken out, and at an individual level, we don't know whether they should or should not be compensated or not. So most of the fines and penalties, and for some of our corporate institutions, restitution was based purely on negotiation rather than any scientific method out there. It's, by the way, the root cause is a culture issue and a conduct issue. It's not an operational matter.
My name is Gary Nelson. I just wanted to ask, you mentioned operational risk appetite.
Yes.
How do you actually go about deciding how much appetite you've got for operational risk? How do you express it?
Okay, so firstly, we currently measure appetite both on a financial and non-financial basis. So from a financial perspective, we have certain loss metrics. So we've got a percentage of gross income that we deem acceptable to lose through to operational risk losses. We also measure operational risk losses against benchmarks in the industry as well across our different markets. And the qualitative measures is exactly what I've mentioned up there. We work at our appetite and qualitative measures per risk type. So for technology, we'll very specifically say what's the uptime on specific systems, what kind of performance do we expect from certain systems. None of it is 100%. It's impossible to have it in 100%. It's too costly. So somebody in Ghana might say, I'm happy with 90, and somebody in South Africa on our core banking platform says, I want 99.5, and the 0.5 must be after business hours. So it's fairly granular. We've got 160 metrics that we use to manage non-loss related appetite. This is done by risk type, but agreed with all the businesses, right? Because if we do move out of appetite, it's them that need to spend the money to bring it back within appetite. So it's done bottom up. We aggregate it, and it's approved by our board on an annual basis. Clearly, during the year, if we do expand into new markets, that's extrapolated into the new markets as well. Different businesses may have different appetite, but the aggregate is actually one that's agreed at our board. We do not have appetite for certain things, zero. So intentional breach of regulations, intentional issues around how we deal with conduct risk or treating customers fairly. So there's certain broad statements that we have in our appetite proposal to businesses where we actually have zero appetite. We don't have discussions around appetite there. It's just do not do these things.
Right. I think we're running a bit over. So thanks everybody. Just give them a hand.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much.